All right. Now, what I want to do now is start a new section. And in this case, we're going to revisit the techniques that I discussed this morning. I'm going to introduce some additional tools to you. But most importantly, I wanted to give you a chance to try out this approach in your lab. So for this, please turn on your laptops if you haven't yet, and turn on the virtual machines, the Windows virtual machine and the Linux virtual machine. You've installed these before the break, and usually I just suspend them, so you can click the pause button. They suspend very nicely. This way you don't have to go through the whole startup process again. So we're going to spend most of our time this afternoon going through this example and learning from it, and then I'm going to cover a few additional topics very, very briefly. Topics like how does malware detect that it's running in VMware, and some additional shortcuts, additional tools that I think might save you some time. To remind you, the approach we're going to use is to infect one of our systems in the lab with a malware sample and see what it does. That's going to be behavioral analysis. And then, once we're done with behavioral analysis, we're going to do some code analysis. So, the example I'm using is called TNNVTIB. I wish they had catchier names than that, but this is as good as it comes, TNNVTIB. In this example, consider a user within your organization or maybe within your client's enterprise, and the user noticed that his system is misbehaving. The system is unstable, it reboots periodically, it's slower than normal, and when the sysadmin looked at that box, he noticed that there's an unfamiliar process there called TNNVTIB. As all these stories go, the antivirus tool didn't help that much to figure out what's going on here, so now you have this executable, it's in your lab, let's try to analyze it. So to begin, please look at the DVD that I gave you. In there, there's a folder called malware. Under it, there's a folder called day one, because this is day one stuff. In that folder, you're going to find tnnvtib.zip. Please bring it into your virtual machine. Extract the executable from the zip file, put it on the desktop of your Windows virtual machine that you're going to be infecting. So there should be malware, day one. And in there, you're going to see tnnvtib. Also, you will notice in that directory is the sample that I analyzed this morning, srvcp.exe. This one, maybe you'll be interested in looking on your own. You can go through the instructions that I presented this morning, try to recreate them. I'm saying this because as we go through this exercise, we're going to be working on it step in step with each other. So I'm going to show you some things, give you a few minutes to try it, and then I'm going to continue with this exercise. Inevitably, some of you are going to be faster at doing this than others. So if you finish earlier, you're waiting for others to catch up to you, then maybe take a look at srvcp.exe. So in this case, I grabbed tnnvtib, and I'm just extracting the executable onto my desktop. The zip file is protected with the password malware. So it's common practice among malware analysts when they exchange malicious executables, they password protect them in a zip file. The most common password that's used is the word infected. That's just tradition. And I guess I'm breaking away from tradition by using the word malware. But it's just so that you think extra hard before you extract something from it. I want to make sure you realize this is malicious. So malware researchers, when they send malware to each other, they password protect it in zip files, mostly to prevent accidental execution. And in some cases, to prevent antivirus from stripping these attachments away. So, you know, it's weird to be working in an industry where I tell my friends, if you see a virus, send it my way. I'd like to receive it. But remember to password protect it in a zip file. One of the first analysis steps that most people take before even getting their hands dirty with anything else is to calculate the signature of the executable, the MD5 hash, or sometimes the SHA-1 hash, SHA-1. This is a way for us to make sure that we're all working with the same exact executable. And it is common practice to include a hash of the executable that you've analyzed as part of your report. This way, when another analyst is analyzing an executable, they can confirm that they're working off the exactly the same file. So, if you have a minute, if you've already booted up, please go and calculate the MD5 sum of the executable that I gave you. Yours should match what you see on the screen. This is a way for us to confirm it's working. We are all working off the same executable. There's another reason why it's useful to calculate this hash. When you perform your analysis, when you infect your system, inevitably new files will appear. And you will wonder, what are those new files? Are they completely separate from what you started analyzing? Or are they actually just copy of the original executable? Regardless of what they're going to be called, if you have the MD5 sum of the original executable, this is your way of confirming that the new files that have appeared are different and distinct, or maybe just copies of the original. And yet another reason why it's useful to calculate this hash is that you can search the web to see what information, if any, has been published about this exact file. In many cases, when I Google the MD5 hash, I might get a hit. Not in many, but in some cases. Also, you've got a site like VirusTotal, which is a free tool for scanning an executable with 20 different antivirus tools, or maybe they got 30 now. Well, even if you don't want to upload the executable to them, you can still search their knowledge base using your hash to see if somebody has uploaded the same file there before, and if so, you're going to see their results. Also, another forum for analyzing malware, offensivecomputing.net. People publish their findings there. People share malware samples there. You can search that forum using the MD5 sum, and sometimes you might come across an answer to your question, what is this? Has anybody seen this before? So it's useful to do something as simple as calculate the hash of the executable, but not very exciting. Something that's a bit more exciting is to actually start the tools that are going to monitor your system when you infect it. And we're going to start with Process Monitor. So Process Monitor is a tool that I would like you all to start. It's one of those free sysinternals tools. And when you start Process Monitor, the newer versions present you with this box right away to ask you, do you want to filter something? And usually I don't filter anything. I just cancel out this box. I want to capture everything. I want to see everything. So when you're presented, if you're presented with a filter box, just press cancel. And you're going to see Process Monitor will start capturing right away. And look, it's been running for about 10 seconds now. And already it has captured about 50,000 events. And my system isn't even infected yet. So you're going to be dealing with a lot of noise, of course. That's why as soon as you start this tool, click the magnifying glass button to pause capture or press Control E. This way, it's not collecting noise. This way, you're going to only begin capturing immediately before you're ready to infect your system. So please, begin Process Monitor and then click the magnifying glass button to pause capture. Pause capture, also press Control X, and that's going to clear the log file. Control X will clear the log file. You can also do the same thing by pressing the eraser head button. Now, I'm handing out this cheat sheet that I created for this course, and I thought it'd be a good idea to hand this out because this has all the shortcuts that you're likely to find useful, especially when we start doing code analysis and OLLI debug and IDA Pro. And in a way, if somebody asks you, what did you learn in these 4 days, it can be summarized very succinctly on this one page. So you might find it useful to have this cheat sheet available with you throughout the day and throughout the days of the course. It describes the general approach we're going to take and some of the shortcuts. When you run Process Monitor, if you don't see any events here, but you still think it's capturing information, it's maybe because you have a filter defined that's eliminating all of these events. If you think that a filter is unnecessarily eliminating your events, you can go to the Filter tab, press Reset Filter, and it should start capturing normally. But of course, right now, we're paused, and I click the Eraser Head button, and the log is clean. Now I can minimize this tool, because I want to talk to you about another tool, and that's Process Explorer. Please start Process Explorer. This is going to be a replacement for the Task Manager, and I want you to start Process Explorer now so that you're familiar with the way your process listing looks before you infect it. This way, it'll be easier for you to notice things that don't belong there. And Process Explorer, in my case, I usually keep it running, minimized throughout my analysis so that I can see what processes start up, I can look at their properties, I can try to kill them. So I'm going to keep Process Explorer running and minimize. So I've got Process Monitor running, but it's paused. And I have Process Explorer, but it's minimized. There's a new tool that I wanted to introduce to you, or at least it's a tool that I did not mention before, and it's a tool called RegShot. RegShot is a change detection tool. So a popular one that people sometimes use to do this kind of work is InControl 5, I believe. So RegShot does something similar. What RegShot will allow you to do is to take the snapshot of the state of your file system and of your registry before you infect your box. That's going to be our first snapshot. Then we're going to infect the system and use this tool to take a second snapshot, and then we're going to use RegShot to compare the two. The idea is to have a report that shows us what has changed on the system that we infected. Any new files that were created, any registry keys that were modified and deleted. This is the sort of stuff that RegShot is going to show you. And it's a free tool, and it does this one thing, and it does it really well, so I really like it. So, please start RegShot. When you start RegShot, there will be one setting that you will need to change, otherwise it won't work the way it should. That setting is called ScanDir1. You see, by default, RegShot will only scan the registry, but we also want it to scan the file system. So you need to enable this ScanDir1 option. It's just a checkbox. And I also need to tell it to not only scan the Windows folder, but I want it to scan the whole C drive. C:// This will tell it to scan all of the local file system. So remember to enable scanning directory and to tell it to scan the C drive. Once you do this, click the first shot button and you're going to have an option. Do you want to shoot or shoot and save? This is what's going to allow us to take the first snapshot. You've got an option. You can save that snapshot into a separate and distinct file that it can preserve for posterity, or you can just save that file into a temporary directory. And frankly, I don't usually bother to save this. I just say, just shoot. It's going to take the snapshot and save it into some temporary folder. So please click on that. And it's going to take maybe about a minute to scan the file system and the registry and save their state in a temporary file. In my case, it was pretty fast, actually. Kind of cool. I got a new system that's got a solid-state drive in it that really seems to speed things up. So when it's scanning, what it does is it takes checksums of all the files that it locates and of all the registry keys. And then it's going to scan again later on, and it's going to tell us if any of them have changed. That's what it's doing. So it's not doing any strong cryptographic hashing there. It is possible, potentially, to modify a file system in escape detection by RegShot, but I have yet to see anybody bother. So it's a pretty good tool for what it is. Also, just to fill in the space while we are waiting for it to scan, I thought I'd mention that it's important to have Process Monitor not capturing while you're doing this. Because if Process Monitor is running in the background, this is going to generate so much noise, you might as well reboot your virtual machine. So that's why I tried to emphasize, pause Process Monitor. Yes. So you're wondering, is it creating its own file system driver, or does it use Windows API? It uses generic Windows API. So you're right, yep. If you are dealing with a rootkit, RegShot will not detect it. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we'll talk about rootkits. So far, we're dealing with malware that does not have rootkit capabilities. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. But here's another tool that I thought I'd mention to you that has a slightly stronger chance of detecting malware, even if it is rootkitted, and that tool is CaptureBat. CaptureBat is similar to Process Monitor. CaptureBat is able to observe file system, registry, and process-level activity, and it saves the activity into a log file, just like Process Monitor, except that CaptureBat is a command line tool. So you might wonder, why should we bother with CaptureBat if we already have Process Monitor? I'm of the opinion that it's useful to have at least two tools that do the same thing. look at the same set of events from two different perspectives. Because even if for some reason one of my tools does not work properly, I can still see it in another tool. So I like having two different perspectives on the same set of events. And in some cases, I have not seen things in Process Monitor, but I noticed them in CaptureBat, and the other way around. So CaptureBat is a command line tool. You install it, and let me show you how to launch it from the command line. So I just type CaptureBat. Now, it loads its own kernel driver for monitoring process and registry-related activity, and for the file system activity as well. So does it a little bit differently than Process Monitor. Now, in Process Monitor, I would have already had 50,000 events that it would have recorded. CaptureBat normally shows me what it finds on screen, but look, it's not recording anything. Why is that? That's because CaptureBat comes with several default filters that are configured to eliminate the most common noisy Windows events. And that's one of the reasons I like the tool. It's been running for half a minute now and has yet to produce any false positives. Very convenient. Of course, therein also lies the danger of this tool in that those filters could eliminate something useful. That's why I like having both CaptureBat and Process Monitor. So I've got CaptureBat listening. And now we're ready to infect our system. But of course, before you do that, remember to activate monitoring in Process Monitor. So go ahead. Click the magnifying glass in Process Monitor and then double-click on your malicious executable. And let it run for about half a minute. Half a minute should be plenty of time. After it runs for half a minute, kill it, pause capture in Process Monitor, and start looking through the logs. Anybody able to install to get CaptureBat working, or is it all like trying to reinstall itself again in your cases? It keeps trying to reinstall itself, right? But in some cases it works. All right, let's revisit that during the break. CaptureBat is not absolutely necessary for us, so as long as we have Process Monitor, we'll be okay. I'll show you CaptureBat on the screen, and then maybe during the break we can troubleshoot to see why it did not install in some cases. But as long as you got Process Monitor, you're okay. Program files, capture. So, remember to activate Process Monitor, double-click on the malicious executable, let it run for about half a minute, then pause Capture Monitor, pause CaptureBat, and you can do that in CaptureBat by just pressing Ctrl-C or pressing Enter. Ctrl-E will pause capturing in Process Monitor, or the magnifying glass button. And then to clear the log, it's Ctrl-X. All right. So I'm activating Process Monitor in my case. And then as quickly as I can, I infect the system. And I'm going to wait about a half a minute. Why half a minute? I don't know. It just seems like half a minute should be plenty of time for malware to do something that's worth observing. And I think now it's about had enough, so I'm going to pause capture by pressing the magnifying glass again. I am able to see the malicious executable in Process Explorer, and I can kill it. And now I'm going to pause capture and capture back. You can do that by pressing Enter or by pressing Ctrl-C. Pressing Enter is the cleaner way of doing that. Pause, capture, and capture bat on Process Monitor, and you've terminated the malicious process. Take a few minutes to look through the logs. Process Monitor, there's going to be a lot of noise, but maybe you can filter through it. Capture bat, there should be less noise, but capture bat might guide you through what to look for in Process Monitor. And we're looking for things like suspicious file system activities, interesting registry keys that it's trying to access, that sort of stuff. In some cases, capture bat didn't work, don't dwell on it. We'll get more exciting things to look at. Process Monitor is pretty comprehensive, and so if CaptureBat didn't work for you, Process Monitor will capture the information. Yep. Also, now might be a good time to take a second snapshot using RegShot. So once your monitoring tools are no longer monitoring, take a second snapshot using RegShot. Once the second snapshot is taken, the Compare button will light up, you'll be able to compare the two snapshots, and it'll give you a report, what has changed. Some of those changes will be just noise, irrelevant. Some of those will be meaningful. So go ahead and generate that report. I usually let it run for no more than a minute, probably no less than 30 seconds. There is some hour that's timed to run at a particular date, that's right. So if I ran it and I saw no changes, then I say, all right, so something's going on here. Maybe I need to start doing some code analysis to see if there are any dates hard-coded into this thing. But most malware that I've been analyzing, it's more straightforward. It just runs and tries to infect the user. So I'm gonna take a second snapshot. And once the second snapshot runs, the compare button lights up. And I can compare the two snapshots to see what has changed. Not all the changes will be malicious. Realize that Windows changes the registry all the time. It does whatever it does in the background there. Some of your monitoring tools may have left a footprint on the registry. But some of those changes might be meaningful. So we're looking for those kinds of things. Does anybody not have Lord PE? So Lord PE is actually missing from the DVD that I gave you because my antivirus tool decided to delete it while I was mastering it. So if you have Lord PE, the actual executable, then you're good. No problem. Sure. No, chapter bad. This is all I can find. Yeah, so certainly process monitor gives you a lot more details. You have it? Yeah, it's going around, yeah. Anybody stuck?
Push prize? You know the Windows firewall is blocking access. So that screwed up my after that, there's all kinds of stuff on there.
Windows firewall should not have interfered with this, because this thing is not listening on any ports, so it should not have bothered you. But
yeah,
but maybe something else did. Maybe some other. Let's try it again.
Should I disable the firewall?
You can, but you shouldn't need to. I have my Windows firewall enabled. Yeah, let's give it another. Let's try it again. In the snapshot, any meaningful changes that you think are worth looking at? Yeah. The registry key creation. What did you see it create? So you notice that it creates a key under the run to automatically run when the user logs in. Yeah. Let's take a look at my RegShot log. And there's of course a lot of noise. And after you run this tool a bunch of times, you'll get a good sense for what is just noisy and irrelevant and what is meaningful. And let me see here. Wow, that was a lot of noise. Here it is. So this is the HK local machine software, etc. run/update, and it wants to run TNNBTIB every time the user logs in. So the key is called update. Something innocuous, something a sysadmin might overlook, but of course it doesn't matter what it's called, it's going to run this program. And correspondingly, you should notice that a file was added to your Windows directory called tnnbtib. What is that file? Well, it's got the same name as the file that we began the analysis with. Is it identical, or is it a somehow modified, expanded, extracted file? If you calculate its MD5 hash, you will notice that this file is identical to the one that we began our analysis with. So it looks like it just copied itself there. So it copied itself there, and it created a registry key to run automatically when the user logs in after rebooting the system. Now, anybody knows what's the deal with these prefetch files that were created? So Joel is saying that whenever Windows runs an application, it creates a prefetch file, and it's to optimize some of the ways in which Windows runs the program. So it's going to be a little bit faster to run it again next time. So So these are the prefetch files. So you can sometimes get a sense for what programs were recently executed if you look at the prefetch files. And notice that there are two instances of TNNDTIB here. Any thoughts on why there are two instances of TNNDTIB? Because it actually ran two different instances of TNNDTIB. One was on the desktop, and the other one was probably from the Windows directory. So they're slightly different. Two files might be identical, but they have different names. And then I have a prefetch file to capture bat, because that's the executable that I ran, so it created a prefetch file there. And these are really the only meaningful changes that I noticed. Does anybody have anything related to Internet Explorer activity? Like Internet Explorer zones, right? Something like that? Let me see if I notice that here. It tries to change proxy server settings. Yeah, I noticed that too. Let me see. I don't have much of that in my log file right now for some reason. But so I think those changes related to the Internet Explorer, related to its proxy server and to the zones, I think they're false positives. I think they're false alarms. And I say that because a lot of the malware that I have seen leaves the same footprint on the registry. It accesses those specific registry keys related to Internet Explorer. From what I have seen, it is a side effect of the malicious executable loading some DLL that provides Internet access functionality. Remember that whole Microsoft antitrust case where Microsoft was saying that Internet Explorer is really part of the OS? Well, it looks like it really is as far as DLLs are concerned, because if you load a certain DLL to connect to the Internet, it will use Internet Explorer functionality to do that. So it's not like the malicious executable is spawning Internet Explorer, or it's not like it's messing with its keys. It is just a side effect of it using a DLL for Internet access. So what we can learn from those registry keys is most likely that this program has some Internet access capabilities. That's it. Does that indicate that malware might be proxy aware? That is a good theory, actually. Most of these DLLs, because they use just Internet Explorer settings, if Internet Explorer is configured to use a proxy, well, it's going to automatically go through the proxy then, yeah. And I'll show you some examples where we'll see the way that the API call is called. If a certain value is specified 0, it basically says, just use whatever Internet Explorer is configured to do. Yeah. So that's RagShot. Not too much noise, not too bad. Yeah. Winalysis. Oh, that Winalysis sounds really familiar. It's a similar tool to RegShot, if I remember, right? Now, is Winalysis free or is it a commercial tool? It's like $30 or something like that, maybe? Oh, yeah. InControl is one tool. We have a gentleman in the back who uses that tool and has come to rely on it. Winalysis is another popular tool out there. I tell you, RegShot rarely fails me, and it does what it needs to do, so I just end up using RagShot. And I think it's open source, too, so if you're one of those people where you don't trust the tool unless you see its source code, then maybe RagShot is a tool for you as well. Yeah. But I heard good things about Winalysis. So we saw the file added. We saw the registry key created. Here is something that I pulled out of my CaptureBat findings. I cleaned up the log. Now, CaptureBat sends its output to stdout, standard output. So this is where the output is. And so normally, I wouldn't just launch CaptureBat, I might redirect its output to some temporary file. But in this case, I can just scroll through this to see what happened, and let me show you these findings on my screen, because I cleaned them up a little bit to eliminate some of the noise. There's not much noise, actually. But here is what I can see. I can see that Explorer.exe created TNNDTIB running off the desktop. Why is that? Well, because I double-clicked on the executable, so I interacted with it using Explorer.exe, that's the Windows GUI, and I launched this process. That's what the first record is about. Then I can see that TNNDTIB is running, and it's writing into the Windows folder. This is what it turns out later will be a copy of the executable, so you can actually see it writing there. Then there's a set value key. It's actually creating this registry key. And then, look at this, I see a record that says that TNNDTIB that's running from the desktop creates another process, also called TNNDTIB, it's running from the Windows folder. So this malicious executable seems to copy itself into Windows, and then it launches itself from that location. and then eventually terminates because I killed it. So this is what happened at a very high level. If we wanted to drill into details, or especially in some of your cases, I know Capture Bad did not work. Well, that's what Process Miner is about. Process Miner is a pretty stable tool. I've never really had it crash on me. It's, well, actually I did, but it's been behaving pretty well. The challenge is, of course, sifting through all the noise there. But especially if you export it into Excel, you should be able to see records that matter. Here, for instance, I highlighted a record. This is on your page 132, where tinnbtib is creating the file, tinnbtib.exe in Windows. And at the bottom, I scrolled a bit further, and I can see rexset value, where it's creating that registry key. It's useful when you do your analysis to look at the same set of events from two different perspectives, confirm that they all see the same thing, confirm that one tool did not miss something important. And RecShot gives you additional context. For example, CaptureBat doesn't show you whether that creation was successful or not. It doesn't show you some of the details that Process Miner would show you. There's another feature that was recently added to Process Miner, so if you've used the tool a long time ago and didn't look at it recently, you might find that this is new to you. There are some, under Tools, you can see Process Activity Summary, and it's actually going to show you some of the ways in which your processes behaved, which processes were executed. So you've got some information in the report there. You've got some, you can create some filters around registry reports to look at the number of events associated with different registry keys and how many writes and how many reads. And let me see. Well, nothing that is useful in this particular report. Here, for example, this is kind of useful. What I did is I went to Tools, File Summary, by Folder. And now I can see, well, which program had events associated with different folders. And I can see which processes, which files were touched and how many times, how many events were associated with a different folder or with a given file. But realistically, I usually just export it into Excel and I do my filtering from there. All right. The new file was a copy of the original. By the way, the fact that it's a copy is a little bit strange to me. You notice that the original file remains on your desktop, right? This might not be meaningful, but most malware like this that I have seen ends up moving itself into Windows rather than copying itself. Is that meaningful or not? Maybe not, but it was a little bit weird, so that's something that I might have written down in my report. Something worth checking out. All right, So far, with some behavioral analysis, we've located a registry key that it creates and a file that it creates. And that might be enough in some cases to have a script run on all of the computers in your enterprise to see what other systems have this file or have this registry key. But of course, there's more for us to learn about this program. Specifically, I'd like to understand its network activity. So we're going to repeat this experiment, but this time we're also going to have a network sniffer running. So, at this point, make sure that you have terminated your malicious process, and also you no longer need Process Miner. You can minimize it if you want to look at it again. I'm not going to refer to it in this example anymore. So I'm going to terminate RecShot and Process Miner. And I'm going to reinfect my system, but first I want to launch my sniffer. To do that, please go into Remnix. You need to be in X Windows. If you're not in X Windows, you can start X Windows by typing start X. And then, once you have a terminal prompt in X Windows, you can start Wireshark by typing Wireshark. And I'm going to do the same. If it prompts you for a password, the password is malware. So one of the nice things about VMware Workstation is that it simulates the network as if it's implemented using a hub. And I know security people usually don't like hubs because it's too easy to sniff stuff. Well, we like a hub in our lab. So it's convenient that VMware simulates the network as a hub. This way, any system on that host-only network will see all of the laboratory network traffic. So we can run our sniffer in Linux and see what's going on as far as the Windows box is trying to communicate with the network. So to launch your sniffer, you go into Capture, Start, or just press Control E, and that's going to begin sniffing the network. Control E. Right now, my system isn't infected. I see a bunch of broadcasts that I can usually ignore. And once the sniffer is running, let's reinfect. So reinfect your system after Wireshark is running. Run the malicious executable again for about 30 seconds while Wireshark is running. Then terminate the malicious process, look at your logs. Now, would you revert to a snapshot? That's a good question. And in this exercise, we don't need to revert to a snapshot. I agree, if you want to be really clean and precise, it is more accurate to start from the very beginning. But I end up usually taking shortcuts, and usually I don't revert. But it would be safer, I agree. So I've got Wireshark running. I'm actually going to clear the log. And now I'm going to reinfect, and I'm not bothering to revert to another snapshot. I think it's fine as is. And now I can start looking at the network traffic to see if there's anything worth observing there. And I should be able to see some DNS traffic. And after you've had a chance to run this program for about half a minute, yeah, terminate the malicious process. We don't need it anymore. Stop capturing Wireshark by pressing Control E and look through the network traffic. What is it looking for? If it's DNS, what host names is it trying to resolve? If it's not DNS, what else is going on? And if anybody gets stuck, let me know and I'll help you troubleshoot before you spend too much time on going down perhaps the wrong path. See three different host names that are being resolved. What are the host names that are being resolved? Are you able to see it? irc.slim.org.au, yep. malwarecourse.sense.org, and there should be one more, that's the hardest one to notice. Yep, sb.webhub.org. Let me show this to you. So, here's the DNS queries that I noticed in my log. In the very beginning, it looks for sb.webhub.org. Then later on, it tries to access malwarecourse.sense.org, and then it also tries irc.slim.org.au. Malwarecourse.sense.org and irc.slim.org.au, it'll keep trying over and over again, but it looks like sb.webhub.org, it only tries in the very beginning once. Is that consistent with what you're seeing? Yeah. So, I customized this executable a little bit to use the hostname malwarecourse.sense.org. That's just the signature that I built into this particular program. But it is a program from the wild, so it's not like I customized it for this class. I just customized it a little bit. So what do we do now? Well, we want to know what functionality is associated with these hostnames. To understand what port it wants to connect to on any of these hosts, we need to allow it to resolve these host names. I mentioned to you earlier that I liked changing one thing at a time. So instead of allowing all three host names to be resolved, pick a single one. Allow it to be resolved, repeat your experiment, and see what happens next. And just so that we're all in sync with each other, please use this one, malwarecourse.sense.org. So terminate the malicious process and edit the hosts file on your infected system to tell it how to resolve malwarecourse.sense.org. You need to give it the IP address of your Linux VM, and your IP address is going to be different probably from the one that's on your slide. If you've edited the host file, what I typically do after editing the host file, just because it's easy to make a typo, you don't. If you're looking to start a DNS server, don't, because I'm going to show you a little script later that will make things easier. Well, you're correct. There is no DNS, so it's not resolving the host names. That's why what I'm doing is I'm editing the host file on my Windows box, and I'm saying 192.168. Yeah. So usually that's what I do. And I'm going to explain to you why shortly. 92.1.8. So I'm saying if you're looking for malwarecourse.sense.org, I'm giving you the IP address of my Linux box. And after you've edited your host file, ping that sans.org. Make sure it resolves, because it's too easy to make a typo when you edit the host file. And it looks like it's working for me. So yeah, definitely ping malwarecourse.sans.org. Make sure you get a response from your Linux virtual machine. This way, you can edit the host file. You don't need to bring DNS into this environment. And here's the thing. I don't like using DNS, because DNS will allow it to resolve all host names. And then it will resolve all three host names. Why is that bad? Well, because if it resolves all three host names, and I see three different types of actions on the network afterwards, I won't know easily which action and which activity is associated with which host name. So that's why I take it one host at a time, and that's why I just modify the host file in most cases. Yeah. And the Linux virtual machine, and there, you're not familiar with the Enlightenment desktop that I'm using. So in this case, I use Enlightenment because it's very lightweight, and a lot of people coming to this class, they don't have a lot of RAM in their systems, and this is definitely friendlier than GNOME or KDE on your hardware requirements. So from that perspective, Enlightenment works really well. You can try to mess with settings, and you can increase your resolution, perhaps during the break. But right now, it does what we need it to do. It's a pretty stable distro. It's got Wireshark installed, and it works pretty well. If you minimize something and you want to get it back, there's a little area here, and you just click on the icon that you minimized, and it's going to come back to you. So yeah, that's a little strange usability feature, if you will, of Enlightenment. So now that I've modified my host file, I'm going to start CaptureBat again. I'm going to start Wireshark again. I'm going to repeat my experiment, but now it should no longer be trying to resolve malwarecourse.sans.org. Instead, it's going to show me that it's trying to connect to a port on that host. And my question is, what port is it trying to connect to? So please go ahead. Now that you've edited the host file, start capturing Wireshark again, reinfect your box, let it run for about half a minute, pause capturing Wireshark, take a look at the traffic again. A lot of malware analysis involves repeating these steps, but you're repeating every step after you've made some change to your environment, and hopefully you're learning something new after every experiment. Wireshark isn't working, or anything like that? Let me show you what I saw on my screen when I took the screenshot. So, it should no longer be trying to resolve malwarecourse.sans.org, because it's got the host file entry for it. It'll still be trying to resolve those two other host names. That's okay, we're not looking at them just yet. You should see the packet that I'm showing at the bottom of the slide. This is where my virtual machine, which in this case is .128, talking to what it thinks is malwarecourse.sans.org, but is actually my Linux box, and it looks like it's using port 6666. You see it's sending a SYN packet. My Linux box, on the following packet, provides a response. The response is a reset packet. It says, I'm not listening on that port, but I do acknowledge that you're trying to talk to me there. That's okay, because now we know what to start. What do we start? Well, port 6666 is typically used for IRC, so let's start an IRC server there. So, you can terminate for now or pause capture in Wireshark. You terminate the malicious process, and we repeat our experiment again. Take a step back. What is it that we're doing by going through these steps over and over again? It's a very iterative process. Well, we perform one experiment, and we learn that malware is seeking something. It's trying to access a port, or it's looking to resolve a host name. So we've learned something about malware from this one experiment. Then we changed our environment a little bit to give it what it wants. But be careful not to introduce too many changes, because if you introduce too many changes, then you might see too many different behaviors afterwards, and you won't know why it is you're seeing what you're observing. So you see it's looking for something, you give it that something, and it shows you something new. And then you change your environment again according to what it looks for, and then it's going to evoke additional behavior. So you're being very gentle. It's like, I don't know if you remember when you if you saw a squirrel in the park and you're trying to give it a little piece of bread that you have, you got to be very gentle or it's going to run away. So you're very careful with malware. You make one change at a time. You don't want to spook it. You don't want to introduce too many changes that are going to get malware all too excited and it's going to do too much. That's really the process that I'm showing you here. And doing it in the class is a little bit slower than you would do it probably if you're there concentrating on this task on your own.